You're listening to the FQXI Podcast. Welcome to the new edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute, broadcasting across the multiverse.
Wait, is that technically correct, Brendan? Can we actually be heard in neighboring universes across the multiverse? What exactly do you mean by the multiverse here anyway? A quantum multiverse in which many parallel worlds exist, with alternative realities splitting off every time a quantum experiment is performed?
Good question. There is a sort of multiverse in quantum mechanics. I was thinking of the different idea that there's a cosmological multiverse with many neighboring universes, each created from their own Big Bang. A lot of cosmologists now think that's true, and these baby universes each have their own laws of physics.
What confuses me is why we don't just redefine the whole lot of neighboring universes as one big universe anyway. Why do we call that the multiverse, and how do we differentiate the cosmological multiverse from the quantum multiverse?
You're asking me to answer that?
No, I'm not, Brendan. No offense, but I decided to ask FQXI member and Nobel laureate physicist Frank Wilczek, who has been musing about multiversality, both the cosmological and the quantum versions, and thinking about how to define the multiverse, what evidence there is that a multiverse exists, and whether we can find experimental support for these ideas. Many of his thoughts will be published in the journal Classical and Quantum Gravity. When I spoke with Frank earlier, he told me how he would go about defining the universe, as distinct from the multiverse, in the cosmological context, first of all.
Well, one of the great triumphs of 20th century cosmology, the big triumph in many ways, is the establishment of the fact that laws really are universal, the same fundamental laws that are now embodied in the standard model apply everywhere we've looked. And furthermore, the contents of the universe, the chemistry and the density of stars, the kinds of objects that form, is also pretty uniform. So that's the universe. That's the conventional universe, the universe with a capital U. The multiverse concept is that, in cosmology, is basically that there are faraway regions where the laws of physics and or the contents, the kinds of things that are inhabiting space, are significantly different from what we've seen to date.
On a personal level, does that surprise you? Or I guess that idea has gained more and more credence, or it's become more and more popular over the years. But just in terms of your personal feelings, yes, about thinking about the universe, is that something that's a strange idea to you, or does it seem very natural?
It's both strange and not strange. In a sense, it's the most natural thing. Why should everything be the same everywhere? It took centuries of hard work and surprising discoveries to establish that idea. And now, after a few decades, we seem to be abandoning it again on much more tenuous grounds. The observations that establish the uniformity of the universe and the uniformity of the laws are voluminous and precise and powerful. The ideas that suggest the multiverse, while interesting and very possibly right and, winning perhaps majority adherents, are by no means on the same level of precision or as the kinds of observations in great detail that support the uniformity of the laws and the contents. It surprises me in the sense that I definitely grew up in the heyday of establishing the uniformity of the universe, and also at a personal level, I guess, I lived through the great triumphs of fundamental physics, the establishment of the standard model and bringing our knowledge of the laws of physics to a wholly new level.
I guess that brings us to the issue of evidence for the multiverse, and you've sort of already touched on how there isn't as much direct evidence for that as there is for some of the other ideas that have become established in physics.
Oh, to say the least. No, there's hardly any evidence at all. It's a tissue of speculation.
I like that, a tissue of speculation. So what I was sort of going to say is that I guess one of the sort of the indirect lines of argument that people make is this anthropic argument, yes, that kind of says, well, you know, if you look at certain quantities, certain physical constants, in the universe at the moment, they seem kind of ideally suited to allow life to arise. And physicists have been having a lot of difficulty explaining their origin. Yes. And in some sense, I guess you could explain it better than I could, the multiverse gives some sort of explanation for that.
There are also a lot of loose ends, so-called parameters of the standard model. I mean, they're a finite number, a couple of dozen. Things like the value of the up quark mass, the value of the down quark mass, various things that have values that are determined by experiment, not by general principles. And a few of them, if they were significantly different, would make life considerably more difficult, or the emergence of intelligence in anything like the form we know it, very difficult. On the other hand, again, it's a pretty loose argument. There are other parameters, like the top quark mass, the mass of the bottom quark, their mixing angles. But most of the parameters in the standard model that we don't understand have nothing to do with life, and we don't understand those either. I mean, all that suggests, if you use your imagination and have a certain sense of humor, that maybe these parameters are a symptom of a fundamental indeterminacy, that the laws of physics don't determine what those parameters are, and in fact they can be different in different places. And then the reason that we see the parameters we do is because we're in a particular place where we are. So some of it is just accidental, it would be different elsewhere. So the anthropic idea, that anthropic idea has some explanatory power, maybe.
And so I guess, you know, in the paper that you wrote, which was kind of sort of musing about different elements of the multiverse, you brought out some of, I guess, the negatives of taking that line of thought too far.
Right.
I guess there's a sense of maybe giving up on trying to find a more fundamental explanation.
It is hard to give up that vision, especially when we sort of came so close to achieving it. And that has various implications. I mean, one is that it doesn't leave physicists who are interested in improving the fundamental laws with much to do. If they're accidental, okay, they're accidental, so you're out of business, right? Along those same lines, related to that, it's also dangerous because it sort of encourages a defeatism. You may be tempted just to give up because it can't be explained. It's just an accident that really have to be in the multiverse. And so you've missed an insight into how nature works. You've been tempted by this excuse.
So is there a way of addressing this issue, or are we kind of just stuck with this?
No, there's always room for good ideas. Now, I think, for instance, axions are another example.
So axions are these kind of hypothetical particles that have been proposed.
Another apparent coincidence in the parameters of the standard model, there's something called the theta parameter, which is observed to be very, very small. But within the standard model itself, in its unadorned, unenhanced form, this parameter could be anything. And there is a nice way of that does explain this, but it predicts the new equations that are bigger also predict new particles, the most remarkable of which is this thing called the axion. So it's tantalizing because it's just on the verge of being observable, and it also has tremendous cosmological consequences. It could very well be the dark matter.
You know, in some sense, would you relate that to the multiverse?
The basic thing is that if axions really are the dark matter, within a large class of axion models, the ones where inflation occurred relatively recently compared to when axions first formed. So if you form axions first and then inflation, then it turns out that different parts of the multiverse, different regions very far away, would have different quantities of axions filling them. So even though the fundamental laws are the same in every respect, you'd find the density of dark matter, namely the density of axions, would vary from place to place. If you go far enough away, most places would have much more dark matter than what we have here. So we would live in a relatively rare, axion-poor part of the multiverse. But that could be explained because the more typical axion-rich parts of the universe are very hostile to the emergence of intelligent observers.
And so would there be an observation or an experiment we could do regarding axions?
Yeah, there's specific experiments. So this is a part of it. So in principle, you should be able to observe it. Its properties are predictable on the basis of the theory, and that's the good news. The bad news is that the predicted properties make it very difficult to observe, however, not impossible. And there are several proposals in the wind, and some, you know, starting to take form in laboratories. One way to try to detect it would be if the axions really are the dark matter, in addition to the microwave background radiation of photons, there's a background radiation of axions that fills the universe. And although conventional antennas wouldn't pick it up, you can design some really exotic antennas that are based on superconductivity and microwave electronics and sort of very, very, very state-of-the-art cutting-edge electronics that would be able to pick up the axion background. Another thing is that you can predict that if axions exist and form the dark matter, it's predicted within a certain range of axion parameters that axions would form atmospheres around black holes.
In terms of the dark matter search, you know, if axions are making up the dark matter, you're sort of talking about looking at the density of dark matter. Would we make a prediction of that density based on anthropic principles? Kind of relating that to the multiverse, would that be the idea?
Yes, that is the idea. This is the basic content of a paper that Max Tegmark and Anthony Aguirre and Martin Rees and I wrote. And we found that it works. I mean, it works much better than we expected, actually. If you assume that axions form the dark matter in this framework, you can get an estimate of what the most likely value of the dark matter is that observers could find. And it's embarrassingly close to what's actually observed. So, you know, it's very, very tenuous evidence, but it is some encouragement that these ideas might be on the right track.
Did you have another paper up about the sort of the Everett multiverse and many worlds and conservation of energy?
Well, recently, just in the last 2 weeks, I started to be on Twitter. I've been twittering every day. I take half an hour and put something out. and so I linked to this multiversality paper when it came out. And one of my followers asked, what about conservation of energy? How could you possibly have the many worlds of quantum mechanics and still conserve energy? Wouldn't it take a tremendous amount of energy to power all these things?
That's a good question.
It's a very good question, and in fact, it's a question that was asked me by Jerry Friedman, a Nobel Prize winner, my colleague at MIT, said exactly the same thing. He said it differently. He said it much more strongly than I was discussing the many worlds interpretation, and then I was very sympathetic to it. He said, it's obviously nonsense. It conflicts with the conservation of energy, but it doesn't.
And so why doesn't it? Is it that energy only has to be conserved within each universe, or?
Yeah, the real explanation involves the equations of quantum mechanics in a fairly serious way. But, I mean, the mantra is that in quantum mechanics, energy is not a number or a quantity. It's an operator in Hilbert space, and so it has rather different properties than usually people think of energy as a substance, but it's not really a substance in fundamental physics. That's a very abstract explanation. It goes with equations. But a much simpler way of thinking about it is these other worlds in the many world interpretation are very difficult to access.
Right.
And that means that they can't send energy to us. If they could trade energy with us, we would see them. They wouldn't be other worlds. They would be part of our world.
Right.
And conversely, energy doesn't leak out from us to them. So our energy is conserved effectively. Because these other worlds are inaccessible, which, if you think about it, means that the energy can't leak out. If energy could be traded with the other worlds, they wouldn't be other, they would be part of our world. So I'm intrigued by this, and when I have time, I hope in the next few months, but I actually want to try to quantify this issue of leakage from our world to other worlds in the many worlds interpretation. I think it may be possible that, you know, if you really look at sort of the border between classical and quantum mechanical behavior, that you will see that energy is not strictly conserved, that we do leak a little bit into the other world. Of course, they also leak into us. So the average is zero, but you'll see fluctuations that you could ascribe to this kind of influence of the other worlds. That's a very speculative thing, but it's a research project that I definitely want to pursue.
Because I'm thinking about, you know, the standard example that everybody uses when they talk about universes splitting, and they talk about Schrodinger's cat in a box,
yeah.
And he's, yeah. You know, well, she is alive and she's dead at the same time,
right.
And that
right.
There's, you know, in some sense, these two worlds that kind of split.
Yeah.
You know, when you say that energy can't leak from one to the other, I can understand that. But I guess the question is, what about, you know, when you go back and you look at the parent universe where the cat was first put in the box, how does, you know, does energy go from that parent universe to both of the daughters? You know, how does it split at that point?
The energy doesn't split. Each world has its own energy. And that comes, as I said, you really need to go to the equations of quantum mechanics to deal with these verbal paradoxes rigorously. But, you know, a lot of these discussions of Everett and any world interpretation to a professional physicist, like I like to think of myself as, they're kind of frustrating because there are very few numbers and very few experiments. They're all talk. However, I think there should be a subject where numbers are put to those ideas. Because the quantum mechanical world, which governs very small systems, and then on the other hand, when it comes to big systems, we talk about cats and we don't worry about the other worlds and the branches and so forth, even though the wave function definitely has those. But there are things of intermediate size. And nowadays, experimentalists are becoming very adept at exploring these kinds of intermediate sizes and doing very delicate experiments. And that's where I think there's room for really understanding better processes like possible leakage into other worlds and making the whole concept much less nebulous and putting numbers to it, having real experiments.
Well, I hope you do take the time to look into that, because that just sounds like, I mean, that would be brilliant if there would be some way of looking for evidence of these kind of parallel universes, which I think people have sort of given up on. So that would be
fantastic. I don't give up easily.
good.
Yeah.
and will you give credit to the Twitter follower who inspired you on this train of thought?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Co-author the paper.
Gosh, the power of Twitter. You can follow Wilczek at Frank Wilczek, that's WILCZEK, and ask him your own questions. And maybe he'll write a paper for you, too. You can also follow us on Twitter at FQXI, but you probably won't get such profound answers from us.
Frank's jokes on Twitter are usually better than ours, too. You can find links to all these papers on the podcast page, of course. www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. There, you'll also find an extended version of the interview with Wilczek. In this podcast, I've just used clips from his interview, but he had a lot of great stuff to say, and you can hear more of it on the podcast page. It's also worth visiting Wilczek's MIT homepage, where he has collected his thoughts on a bunch of fun physics topics.